Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. My guest today is James L. May. He holds an MFA from Florida International University, along with a BA in English from Cornell. His short fiction has appeared in Tiger Tail, and he reviews fiction for the Florida Book Review, Gulfstream Literary Magazine, and New Orleans Review. And he's joining us today with his exciting new novel. It's called The Body Outside the Kremlin. James L. May, welcome.
Thanks very much, Vicki. Thanks for having me on.
Very pleased to have you here. Great title for the book. I mean, especially with all of everything that's going on now, but it is historical. We'll get into that in just a moment. I want to just learn a little bit about you, James, and what you've been doing up until now. This is your debut novel. Is it something you've always aspired to?
Oh, well, it certainly is. Yeah, I've been at work on this book for, well, quite some time. I guess I started on it about 10 years ago in the MFA program at Florida International. This is the main thing that I've been doing for that time. You know, I've done some other things, teaching at various places, but this is the main project.
Right. So let's take a little look at the story. So much to talk about on this, and I've got loads of notes here. Hopefully we have time to get through them all. But let's just look at the story, the book synopsis. The book is narrated. It's narrated by a political prisoner. I'm going to let you say his name.
It's Tolya Bogomolov.
Okay, and he was incarcerated in what was really the most notorious Russian prison camp of the 20s. So would you tell us a little bit about the storyline?
Well, certainly, yeah. The camp is called the Solovetsky prison camp. And it is it was based in a archipelago in the White Sea, which is far to the north in western Russia, almost on the Arctic Circle. Perhaps the most interesting thing about it is that it was based in what had been a monastery for about 500 years before the Bolsheviks took it over. There's a lot of fascinating stuff about that. They imprisoned many of the monks who had worked there or who had lived there in order to continue their work with a very, very valuable fishery that was there. There's this sort of strange dichotomy of a place that's simultaneously imprisoning a lot of dissidents, really subjecting them to terrible conditions, but also somehow preserving some of the sort of religious life of the former monastery. My character Tolya comes into this as a young man. He's been imprisoned for involvement in a sort of unsanctioned student group, essentially for nothing. It was very easy to be imprisoned at that time, although not quite as easy as it would be later on during some of the the Great Terror. Anyway, he finds himself in this rather terrible prison and looking for almost any way. He's been assigned to a hard labor company. And he's looking for almost any way to improve his situation. One of the striking things about Solovetsky, as opposed to later gulag camps, was that it, along with sort of allowing the monks to keep their religious practices, it also maintained certain sort of cultural or intellectual institutions that were actually run by prisoners. Among them, a so-called museum, which was maintained a collection of the religious treasures that the monks had. So Tolya is making friends with someone who works in this museum, someone who actually restores icons, of which the monks had a very fine collection, hoping that, you know, knowing this person, he'll be able to intervene and get him a better work placement. But unfortunately for Tolya, this friend of his turns up dead one morning. And at first he's sort of suspected, and then for reasons that aren't entirely clear to him at first, The camp administration assigns him to work with the detective who's investigating this murder.
Right, right. And he is he's writing this story 30 years after the event, so he's going back looking at and telling it as an older man, but he's telling his younger man's story. I want to go into that a little bit later on. But, you know, you've talked about the Solovetsky Islands and the prison camp there. I mean, it really was known as a gulag. It's a character in itself, isn't it, really, in the story?
Oh, it certainly is. I mean, a big part of my, you know, a big part of my interest in writing the book was in exploring this, you know, horrifying but simultaneously fascinating place. It was known as it wasn't actually at that time. It wasn't known as the Gulag. It didn't become designated the Gulag until I believe the 30s. But it certainly was. In many ways, it was the place. It was run by the secret police, the way the Gulags were, and it was in some ways a place that they experimented with and sort of refined the formula of what the Gulags would be when they moved them to Siberia.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting for any number of historical reasons.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that site really it's continuing to have historical value. And you tell me if this is right, because I did a very cursory search on this, but and I know you've done much more in-depth research, but so it was a monastery, as you said, and then I read it was attacked by a British ship. Sorry about that. But they left with nothing. And then it became the place of exile for certain people. And then it became a prison. And then they decided when we were heading to World War II, it was too close to the borders, and they turned it into a naval base.
Yeah, that's correct. And it has now been returned to the Orthodox Church, and monks occupy the monastery again. In fact, an interesting sort of, you know, seeing history develop into the present day, there's been an interesting sort of conflict in the past, I suppose it's about 10 years, between the monks who, you know, want to resume their occupation of their monastery, and people who work at the so-called Solovetsky Prison Museum on the island, which is still established in the prison, which was also the monastery. So the monks would like their space back. The people who run the prison monastery very, very rightly think that the prison was, you know, a great tragedy that should be memorialized. It's funny how these things sort of project themselves into modern Russia. I think, you know, the Russian state today is, generally speaking, more interested in promoting Russian Orthodoxy as the state religion than it is in memorializing, you know, the Gulag camps. So I think the museum is getting sort of the short end of it. But
right.
It's certainly an interesting thing.
Right, right. And so tell me how you came up with this idea to base what is essentially a murder mystery, a murder thriller, during this time and at this site. How did you come up with that idea originally?
Well, it's a strangely hard question to answer. I had read about Solovetsky in a book by Anne Applebaum called Gulag, which is, you know, an English language general history of the Gulag, and because Solovetsky is the first camp, she devotes a chapter to it. And at the same time that I was reading that, I was also taking a course on mystery literature, and we'd been talking about, one of the things we'd been talking about was what a good tool a mystery story can be for exploring a place. Because, of course, a detective in a mystery has to sort of go everywhere and poke his or her nose into everything. You know, if you're a detective, you have to sort of learn everything about the place where the crime has taken place. So it's in some ways, it's a really nice mechanism for giving a reader a tour of an interesting spot. Your detective sort of gives the tour for you. So that struck me sort of formally. But, you know, also something about the place just caught my imagination and just wouldn't let go, and in some ways I've been trying to figure out why ever since by writing the book. I really, you know, the way I phrased it at first was, you know, I really would like to read a novel, a mystery novel set in this place, and of course one didn't exist, so I kind of had to write it to figure out all of the interesting things that I would have liked to read.
Right. Well, they say if there's a book you would like to read and haven't, you know, it's not out there, then write it. So
good advice.
So let's talk a little bit about Tolya Bogomolov. He is a mathematician. He's your protagonist. He's only sentenced for 3 years, but as you said earlier, he was looking for... It is a work camp. It's a prison camp. It at one time was called a concentration camp, and then I think they changed it to corrective labor camp or something like that.
That's right. I mean, concentration camp is... Actually, we had some controversy about this in the United States recently. Yeah, but, you know, concentration camp is sort of a general term for a camp where people are brought together on the basis of, some form of identity. In this case, there's an argument, there's an argument about exactly who was imprisoned on Selovetsky and whether it deserves the name, but I think it's probably fair to say that it was.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't a death camp the way that the German concentration camps were, although many people died.
Right. So he is, he's quite young, he's kind of naive in a way, and he gets in there and then he has to become quite canny to survive, really, you know, because some of those jobs outside in those harsh winters they could have been a death sentence in themselves.
Certainly, they were for many people. Yeah, I think one, you know, the basic story is of having this crime solved, but in some ways the larger story that I wanted to tell was about the effect of having to survive in the camp on this, you know, more or less naive young man's emotional life, and as it goes forward for the next 30 years until he comes to tell the story. And you know, he has to be, in the end, he has to be rather hard on himself and on the people around him. He has to in some ways use the people around him in order to solve this crime and to survive. And I think that was, sad to say, that was a rather common experience of the camps, that it just made you, you know, so hard you could do, there was nothing you could do except for look out for yourself. Mm-hmm. It was, as you said, the hard labor companies were in fact a death sentence for huge numbers of people.
Yeah, so it's a case of survival of the fittest under those circumstances, really.
Yeah, I fear so. The fittest, or sometimes the best connected, or you know, often just the lucky. You know, it's not necessarily the case that there's anything you can do to save yourself. But you know, people certainly tried.
Right, and so talk to us about his character as a young man. I'm interested in, as you're writing this, you're writing it as he's an older man, 30 years on, but he's trying to recall his, you know, 30 year ago memories. Did you have to kind of separate those two voices? How did that work for you?
Well, yeah, I did, in fact. Some of the, in fact, most of the sort of looking back, the 50-year-old voice, I sort of wrote in a wholly separate process than the 20-year-old voice. The 50-year-old voice, you know, he's rather hardened, he's sort of cynical. But I think the 20-year-old voice, a lot of that, you know, it's fairly easy to kind of create a character who is a version of yourself. I think there are some of the strengths Tolya has some of them are strengths and some aren't. You know, he's actually not a very good mathematician, or at least he doesn't succeed in making a mathematical career. I mean, it's interrupted by the camps, of course. And I think I identified with him a little bit because I had, you know, been quite interested in math when I was in college, but didn't, people say you hit a wall in math, and I'm afraid I certainly did. I think Tolya actually describes that in the book. You know, also, as it turns out for Tolya, one of his strengths, in some ways a better strength than his mathematical experience, is that he's read a lot of these so-called Pinkertons. And what Pinkertons were Russian pulp mystery stories that were extremely popular, well, in the years leading up to the October Revolution, so the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, they enjoyed a resurgence of popularity in the late 20s and early 30s. So, you know, Russians, there was a huge huge increase in literacy after the communists came to power. They had, in fact, literacy was a huge goal of theirs, or universal literacy, partly because they were capable of transmitting propaganda when people could read. But it also, of course, people made use of it for entertainment. So Tolio certainly sees himself. He sort of realizes that he's part of a mystery story. You know, he says, "Oh, here's a crime. We're trying to solve it. What do I know about that?"
Right.
And what he knows is these mystery stories. And I'm afraid that would be true for me as well. That's a place where I identify with him strongly, because, of course, I've read a lot of mystery stories, but my actual experience solving crimes is exactly nil.
Right, right. You talk about some of the food they ate. I mean, very unappetizing sounding, like cold meal would be bread, onions, salt fish. How much research did you do on that side of things?
Oh, well, quite a bit. I think the research that I found most helpful for that sort of detail was reading memoirs. And of course, the people who wrote the memoirs were just totally preoccupied with food. Just getting the difference between getting an extra 50 calories was the difference between life and death in many cases.
Right.
So many of those memoirs were published contemporaneously, by people who had been either released or, in a few circumstances, escaped from the Selovetsky camp. And they were published in English in the West, usually in England, in some ways as a way of sort of raising the alarm about Bolshevik repression. However, the most interesting memoir I read was by a man named Dmitry Likachev, who was served out his sentence in Selovetsky as a young man in the 20s, and then went on to become one of the most respected scholars in Russia at the time of his death. I believe he died in 1999, and the memoir was published in 1997, so not until quite late in his life. So I certainly found, I think Tolia's voice, you asked about, writing the two different sort of versions of Tolia, the older man looking back and the younger man living through it. I think his voice as an old man is not very much like Likachev's, but I was very interested and sort of inspired by Likachev kind of, living back through it at the end of his life and sort of trying to take account of what had happened to him as a young man.
Right, right. So how did you conduct your research? Did you actually get to go out there, or was most of it, digital?
I'm sorry, would you say again? I'm afraid I lost you for a moment.
Yeah, how did you conduct your research? Did you manage to go out and visit the site? Were you able to do that?
No, I wasn't. This is in some ways to my shame. I had not seen the site, and I was writing along, and at some point I realized, gosh, I have such a vivid sort of picture in my imagination of the camp that I sort of have to continue writing about this island and this camp that as it exists in my head, instead of totally replacing it with a visit to the real place.
Right.
Now I no longer have that excuse. Of course, the book has been finished, but I still haven't managed to go. I will say, I did do quite a lot of research using maps and photographs of the place to really try to develop the sort of three-dimensional model of it in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a good photographic record of Selovetsky, partly because it was a pretty terrible camp, but I think it was cleaned up by the regime in some ways and sort of presented, if you know the term Potemkin village, right? It was sort of presented as much nicer than it was, and so it was used in propaganda a good bit. In fact, there was a propaganda film made of it, so there's actually film of Selovetsky, much of which was used in a Russian documentary that came out, I think in the early 2000s, called Selovki Power. Selovki is a short name for Selovetsky.
Right.
So that sort of thing is certainly available, and then I certainly made a lot of use of that.
Right, right. So as you're researching the life, you're reading these memoirs, you're seeing what daily life was for these prisoners and even the prison guards, and how they learned to survive. What surprised or shocked you the most?
Oh, there's so much surprising and shocking. Let me think. I think, well, in some ways, the sort of inventive cruelty of some of the punishments that were inflicted on prisoners. It was a church, in fact. So the Solovetsky Monastery, it's based in this archipelago, and so there are different monastery sites spread around these islands. And generally speaking, and the prison used all of the sites. So as the prison, you know, as the prison sites got further and further away from the center where the main monastery site was, in some ways the punishments got crueler and crueler. So there was one church particularly called Sekirka, which was known as a sort of penal isolator for prisoners, and the tortures inflicted on them there were really, really horrific. The two that stick most in the mind were, well, the first was, the church was at the top of a rather steep hill. There are said to be about 200 steps leading up to the hill, and prisoners would be tied to a large log and rolled down the steps.
Oh my gosh.
It almost defies belief. It's really hard to picture. And of course, that was, in 99 cases out of 100, that was a way of execution.
Right.
It was, few people survived, and I think those that did may have wished they didn't. The other particularly horrible punishment at Sekirka was, and this I can't understand for the life of me how they got the idea, but they would put prisoners at the tops of very narrow poles and just have them sit there, over high ones, right, so that if you know, 15 feet up, so if you fell off, you were going to hurt yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the torture, the punishment, was just having to stay there. You know, there was the danger, of course, of falling, but then just the sort of excruciation of sitting atop this. I mean, you know, we're talking a 10-foot wide or 10-foot round, or excuse me, 10-inch round pole.
Right.
Excruciation of keeping yourself in balance and, you know, knowing that this fall was liable to kill or hurt you if you fell off just seems, you know. It,
very vindictive.
Understand.
Yeah, very vindictive.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Let's talk about writing a little. The book we're talking about, of course, today, your debut novel, The Body Outside the Kremlin. Was there a favorite scene in there that you just really enjoyed writing?
Well, that's a good question. I think I've been over all of it enough that, you know, if I enjoyed writing one draft of a scene, I would often end up not enjoying much the rewrite, and vice versa. You know, if something was really excruciating to
right.
Sometimes I would find that it was a lot easier and a lot better when I came back to it to rewrite. I think it is probably fair to say, though, that my favorite scenes are the ones involving a character named Veronica. I've been talking about the great majority of the prisoners on Solovetsky were men, but of course there were a number of women imprisoned there as well, and they were mostly kept in isolation from the men, but there was some communication, and indeed people, men and women, established you could call them romantic, or you know, in some cases it would be more accurate just to say sexual relationships between men and women, often in some cases of a coercive type. That is, you know, I'm not describing rape per se, but
but I mean, it's well documented throughout history that they would get certain favors if they complied, or they would be punished if they did not comply.
Yeah, precisely, exactly. So there's a really striking story that emerged from my research was of a woman who described a man that she claimed at least to have fallen in love with at the camp, but the way he seduced her was to say, oh, well, you know, come live with me, I can help you. And she said, no, I don't want to do that to start with. And he beat her very badly. And then when she was in the hospital, he, you know, used his sway in the camp to make sure that she got good care. So she certainly, you know, people's reactions to these things are strange. You know, it always struck me that she said, oh, this was my first camp love. in what appeared to be, you know, an earnest way. But it certainly was a coercive relationship. Anyway, I've got, you asked about my favorite scene. A character named Veronica is a woman who is in a relationship somewhat like this. And in fact, well, anyway, I won't try to describe how she becomes involved in the investigation, but she was certainly my favorite character, sort of trying to figure out how she was, you know, keeping her spirit alive under these circumstances, and how she managed to continue to be herself while weathering these assaults, call them what they are.
Doing what she had to do to survive, really.
Yeah, doing what she had to do to survive, and to keep her, you know, in some ways, how she had to think about it and what kind of attitudes she had to develop to keep her humanity together.
Yeah.
I think partly, you know, it will surprise you. I think she's the funniest character, and she was certainly the most fun to write.
Right.
I liked her the most.
Right. So let's look at the least favorite as a writer in general. When you're, you know, you're putting together your book, what is your least favorite part?
Well, of course, this is something I've thought about a lot. Writers do, I think, like to complain about writing.
Yeah.
I think in some ways it's what I said before. The thing that I have found most difficult about writing, particularly a long project like this, is the fact that, you know, I'll write something one day and think, oh, that's great. I really feel, you know, I feel like, gosh, I'm really doing what I set out to do. And that, in some ways, that's sort of that's the feeling that you chase as a writer. And yet, ultimately, that's a rather fleeting feeling. You know, I can come back a week later and look at it again and think, whoa, you know, what was I thinking? Why did I like that?
I'm laughing because I've been there so many times.
Yeah, well, exactly. And it can feel so frustrating. So, you know, in the end, you know, you can't sort of rely on a good feeling about what you've written to keep you going. You just have to sort of grit your teeth and do it. And sometimes you feel good and sometimes you feel bad, and you just have to convince yourself that, you know, it doesn't matter that much. You just have, the most important thing is to keep going. So that's something I've learned, but it's certainly been one of the hardest lessons for me.
Right. You know, years ago, I watched a great interview with Neil Simon, the playwright. That's his name, right? I have this head cold and everything keeps flying out of my head. But yeah, he said, never throw anything away. He said, because he referenced this play that he'd written, and it had been in his drawer for 10 years because he wrote it and he thought, that is utter garbage. What was I thinking? So 10 years on, he's clearing out his drawers and he starts reading this play and he's like, this is pretty good. And it was Brighton Beach Memoirs.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is one of his most famous pieces. So you just never know. You know, it's also said that writers based on what they do, observe, write, actually see things differently in everyday to life. Do you think that's true? And if so, what does that mean to you?
Well, that's so funny. I guess I have to start by saying I don't think that I, you know, possess any special insight into the situations I find myself in day to day that anybody else doesn't. You know, I don't. There can be a kind of pridefulness in that attitude that is about,
right.
Oh, well, you know,
right.
My vision is so special and unique, that to me is in some ways sort of antithetical to what I'm really trying to do as a writer, which is as a novelist, not necessarily express my own vision, but inhabit other visions.
Mm.
You know, if you're trying to write characters that aren't like you, you know, if your main focus is your own vision, then they all sort of end up kind of sounding the same. You know, they all sort of end up sounding like you.
Yes.
So if there is, I mean, if there's a writerly talent, I hope that I have, or that I try to cultivate, I think it's that ability to sort of not get too caught up in my own way of seeing, to sort of jump from way of seeing to way of seeing.
Mm. That makes perfect sense.
Good.
Yeah. So I see that you are a fiction reviewer. You know, it's I've reviewed. I'm a writer. Have been for a long time. I've reviewed. I've critiqued on judging panels, stuff like that. I find it very hard to critique other people's work. And I find the energy is very different too, whether it's like writing and editing, two different energies, two different approaches. So as a fiction reviewer, do you find that informs your work or it gets in the way a little?
Well, yeah, good question. I think I also find it very difficult to critique. You know, this is, you know, especially adopting a standpoint that is very critical of the work sort of from outside of the work, as in merely saying this is bad instead of saying, as you do when you critique your own work, this is what needs to change. I find that can sort of, you know, it's just such a different way of thinking that it can interfere with my work to a degree. I think there is a way of writing criticism which doesn't produce sort of savage reviews, but I think it can produce some interesting thinking, you know, in which you sort of try to enter into what the writer was trying to do, into the writer's mind. And, you know, sometimes you can critique them from that perspective, you know, that namely, you know, you observe here's what the writer seems to set out to do, and here's where they succeeded, and here's where they failed. That is much more like what I do with myself when I'm critiquing my own work, or indeed what I've done with students when I've taught, or when I've I've done a certain amount of writing tutoring over the years, and that sort of getting into a kind of spirit of sympathetic critique. You know, that can be, I think that sort of critique can be quite useful for my own writing.
Right, right. So we mentioned earlier that you did an MFA, a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. You know, those courses are not inexpensive. So how did it benefit you? Would you do it again? What do you think it was worth it?
Well, that's a great question. Yeah, and you're focusing on the expense is quite right. I think I would do it again. I certainly found it very valuable as an artist, you know, as a writer. The things I learned, you know, about, particularly about plot, I studied with Lynn Barrett, whom I hope your listeners will look her up, because she's a wonderful writer and a wonderful teacher and lecturer on plot issues. I certainly learned a lot that way. That said, you know, as an economic proposition, MFAs, I think, are not good for many people who do them. I don't think I would have wanted to do an MFA if I hadn't received, you know, significant assistance. And I think I probably, if somebody asked me, I probably wouldn't recommend it either.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a whole lot of people go through MFA programs, and, you know, only a fraction of those people are able to publish a book in the first place, much less really make it pay. So you see, it's a tough thing. I think for anyone who was choosing whether to do it, they would have to, you know, they should look at the economics of it quite honestly. But if you can, you know, if you can figure out a way to do it, I certainly found it a very valuable experience. I learned a great deal.
Right, right. Well, now that you've launched your first book, by the time this is published, it will have been out, I think, a whole day. but when you now that you've launched your first book, what have you learned about the process, writing The Body Outside the Kremlin? What have you learned about the process, any part of the process, from writing to publishing, that you wish you'd really understood when you first set out to write your story?
Oh, good question. Well, I think one of the things that has most sort of surprised me during the publication process, after we managed to sell the book, was just the degree to which it was a collaborative process. I think this is not an uncommon thing for people to say, but it was really kind of a shock for me to kind of give the book up and have it not just belong to me anymore, but, you know, it belonged to the editor, who had his own, Joe Olshan, who's a great editor. I really liked working with him, but it was in some way a shock to me to have him have his own ideas about how things should go.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you asked Joe, he would say, oh, you know, I barely did anything. But even to me, it was even so, it was a little bit hard for me to manage that. And then just have, you know, so many people work on a book. The person who does the cover and the copy editor and the people who do the pronunciation guide for the audiobook and the person who reads the audiobook. All of these people have an important role to play in the publishing and marketing of a book. It's striking. In some ways, it's been a sort of happy thing to learn, but it is striking to have the book go out and, as I said, belong to so many instead of just belonging to you.
Right. Well, they did a good job on it. It's one of those books I love with the rough-edged pages. I love those books.
Good. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And the cover, too, The Body Outside the Kremlin. I mean, it's perfect. They did a really good job.
Good. Well, I'm glad you think so. I think so, too.
Yeah. So, James, what is next for you?
Well, I am I have a story. I'm trying to change gears a little bit in a shorter thing. I've been working on a ghost story, and it is about honeybees. It's a little. I always feel a little bit sheepish describing what I'm working on. But if you have honeybees in your house, you have to get an apiarist, a beekeeper, to come in and remove them.
Right.
And they remove the whole hive at once, including the queen. And if you don't, if instead you make the mistake of getting an exterminator to come in and kill the bees, what you end up with is this huge mass of rotting bees and melting honey and wax in your walls. And that somehow just seemed like, it's quite different from the Salvetsky story. But that just somehow seemed sort of macabre and spooky to me in a way that I wanted to explore.
Well, interesting.
I think so. It's going to be interesting. Ghost stories are not something that I have written before, but I've certainly, I've read horror and ghost stories with great interest, and I think I'm sort of was looking for a bit of a change of pace, or at least a palate cleanser from mystery for a minute. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Excellent. We look forward to that coming out. So the book we talked about today is The Body Outside the Kremlin. Publishers Weekly says about it, a richly evocative first novel, gripping. This thriller deserves high marks for the captivating tone of the writing and attention to historical detail about a prison that served as a key link in the Gulag chain. You got some really great reviews there. You should be very proud of yourself. So how are you celebrating your first novel?
Oh, well, we're going to have a reading on Tuesday, and apart from that, we've gone out with friends, but it feels like, it's a funny thing. The celebration sort of has happened already. The publication feels like, it just feels sort of like pushing the boat out to sea, and I'm waving goodbye to it more than sort of celebrating on the boat itself.
Right. So we're right at the end of our segment, James. So a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with. I know they can find out more about you at jameslmay.com. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I think I feel obligated to drop this factoid as widely as I can. I think readers or your listeners should know that the Kremlin that is referred to in the title of the book is not actually the Kremlin in Moscow, which is often the only way we know the term. But in fact, in Russian, Kremlin just means a compound or a walled enclosure in a city. So in my book, the Kremlin is the walled enclosure is the one in the monastery on the island. So that's, if people are wondering if this book is about political intrigue in Moscow, I hope they won't be disappointed to learn that it is not.
No, I'm sure they won't. Well, James, I thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
And again, listeners can find out more about James and his work at jameslmay.com. If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.